Please be seated. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I think tonight in the Vatican there will be tens of thousands of people gathered with lit candles, if I'm remembering the right feast in my mind. I would love to be there in person some year to experience that. So every 6 to 8 years, when Candlemas, or the Feast of the Presentation of the Lord, falls on a Sunday, the Anglican Church has deemed that the readings assigned for this feast as a holy day supersede, if you will, the normal Sunday cycle and the readings that would normally happen for Epiphany 4 in year A. And we might wonder, right off the bat, why that is. Why the great tradition would have marked it this way. And as far as we know, this feast is one of the earliest in the Christian tradition. For the story from our gospel reading does not appear to teach us that much about God, that is, theology, or help us very much as moderns. You know, how can we live from what is in that story creatively and well in the 21st century? And I think in many ways the heart of this story clashes with our assumptions around the type of story we expect the New Testament to tell. Put most broadly, as those who live after the fact, if you will, we expect the New Testament to make and back up a claim about this man, Jesus of Nazareth, who, or in, God has drawn especially close, and that in his appearing, God was not only working, but in person, if you will. And we also understand, I think, up front, that the New Testament can't make this claim in any straightforward way, because it's precisely Jewish theology and monotheism that has made sure to tell us that the true God, the one God, and humans can never be confused. God is creator, humans are created. God is infinite, humans are finite. God can't be in person. So now to say that the one God has become human is a radical but also a very dangerous claim, and must be mostly made, unless misunderstanding is to occur on the most radical level, it must be made indirectly, that is, through stories. And the stories of the New Testament make this radical and dangerous claim by painting for us, in the main, an adult Jesus who contrasts strikingly with the character of God as typically understood, whether in ancient Israel or by men and women on the street today. Now notice I didn't say actually, but as typically understood. It turns out, when I talk to my Jewish sisters and brothers, that they do not find in their scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, what we call the Old Testament, a different kind of God than many Christians find there, or that many non-Christians imagine is portrayed there. To get back to our gospel reading, here we find a different kind of strangeness that confronts us. Because though all adults, I think we would admit, are all quite different, we have our similarities, of course, babies are in many ways all alike. The adult Jesus, whom we're used to meeting in the New Testament, has a highly developed, distinctive, and searing personality that holds in tension a radical inclusiveness, and that's what we really value and cherish about the Jesus we meet in the New Testament. But we tend to overlook the other side because this inclusivity is held in tension, in paradoxical tension, with an uncomfortable commitment to truth-telling. Probably the most radical truth-telling we have recorded from the ancient world. Writing to and within the Roman Empire, it's as if Luke understands that given such a combination, pagan readers, if just confronted with the adult Jesus, would be tempted to think that Jesus was like an Olympian god dropped from the sky, fully formed. And Luke does not want his readers or listeners to think that. But by focusing, again paradoxically, on the baby Jesus, who presumably cried, right? Forget the away in a manger line, no crying he makes, not happening. Cooed and babbled incoherently, suckled at his mother's breasts, and had the messy discharges common to all infants, right? By noting him as an infant, he is able to humanize him, to show us that he's not just a god that dropped from the heavens. And by focusing on the infant Jesus, he releases in us who are listening or reading emotions. Emotions that are not that complicated, really, as simple and as unprovocative as the infant himself. We note that in the story, he's held. And we want to hold him. We want to cuddle him and protect him. And it is part of Luke's genius that he harnesses this emotion to not only humanize, but to contrast with what the angel has announced to the shepherd, that this is Christ the Lord. Christ the Lord. And as we saw from our psalm and our first reading, the designation the Lord is the Hebrew designation for God. As Christ the Lord, reduced now in this gospel reading to the condition of helpless newborn, God's closeness, we begin to understand, is revealed as vulnerability. The great Irish poet, W.B. Yeats, not a practicing Christian, actually very fond of seances and the like, put it this way in his poem, A Prayer for My Son. Though you can fashion everything from nothing every day and teach the morning stars to sing, you have lacked articulate speech to tell your simplest want and known wailing upon a woman's knees all of that worst ignominy of flesh and bone. And we already feel a tremor. We feel a tremor of what is coming for him. Jesus' involuntary defenselessness and infantile ignorance, mirroring his voluntary defenselessness with full knowledge at the end. But there's more. The infinite will draw close to the finite, but to do so must mean adhering to a culture, to being in a place and a time. And in this case, that's very Jewish. And so he is circumcised. And Mary comes to the temple for her purification rites required of all women after childbirth. And then Jesus is brought into the temple to fulfill the law that says that all firstborn sons will be dedicated to the service of God at the temple. But the law of Moses allows parents to redeem their child from a life of temple service by offering something instead. And in the case of poor people, that is two turtle doves or two young pigeons. Thus, the Redeemer starts his life by being redeemed. Redeemed from the service of God, he will be freed to serve God. Paradox. This being part of a culture with all of its strangeness, uniqueness, its strengths, but also its weaknesses, also reveals God's willingness to be vulnerable. Israel, too, felt herself isolated, trapped, in an imperial and pagan empire that generally just mocked her religion, mocked her monotheism. And she always felt like her only option was to fight like hell. Remember when Jacob is fighting with this unknown being? And it's at that point that he's named Israel. Striving with God. Constantly striving for her place. For the scraps of civilization that might fall from the table. But Simeon, another paradox, takes these fighting words of Israel, bits and pieces of militaristic prophecy from Isaiah, prophecies against the nations and their destruction and downfall, and rearranges them to say the opposite. The Messiah is here, and he's going to be a blessing, not just for Israel, but for the world. Your isolation, Israel, is now going to work for your glory and for the world, but there's going to be a great cost on the way. Imagine giving your baby, vulnerable, newborn, to a stranger who takes him into his arms and then says to you, "And a sword will pierce your own soul too." I mean, when Gabriel the angel had visited Mary, she hadn't said anything about a sword. And so then this story today is like the equivalent of Yeats' poem. Jesus, ignorant in his infancy, is handed over to prophetic knowledge, incomplete as it is, of third parties. And those third parties are the very ones who will be saved by the one they cradle. And I guess this is how the story, however I've spun it, becomes relevant for us. At this feast, we are like Simeon, we are like Anna, actually, as we love each other and speak the grace of God, speak the grace of the gospel in our and to our vulnerability and need, we find that God is coming close in vulnerability as well. We find in our particular circumstances that we are cradling the light of salvation in the crook of our community's arm. And as we engage with the reality that is this particular culture, at this time and place, as we engage the laws and customs of our time, the laws and customs of our society, of our churches, other organizations that we're part of, we remind ourselves that in this feast we celebrate the fact that God's truth and light and insight can penetrate any culture and society and draw us out of isolation into our true purpose. Sometimes, like Israel within the wider world, we are isolated and bound in our lives. But in the Spirit, we are not. And as we submit to the Spirit, we find that our fighting words, our inner defensiveness, our need to define ourselves in opposition to, that ends up isolating us from those even we love and from the world, become more and more words and actions for the sake of the world. That's the transformation that we see happening with Simeon and Jesus is in his arms. And so I find this feast beautiful, moving, because in a few minutes we will hold a wafer in our hands, and it will be the real presence of Christ. And as we do in faith, we discover that it is our real presence in the crook of Christ's arms. Maybe a short time coming or a long time, as it was for Anna, but the promise to each of us is that we will feel his strength, be filled with his wisdom, and know God's favor at the core of all our paradoxes. Amen.